right, welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate. And the show today, it's going to be deep. It's going to be deep and long. That's right, yeah. At the back end of the show, we will be talking with members of the cast and the director of a play called Equivocation. And it's really a great play. I really enjoyed it. We'll be talking with the director and the cast at the back end of it, and I look forward to that. In the middle of the show, we'll be talking with Lisa Bloom, trial lawyer, national journalist, and award-winning author whose latest book is Suspicion Nation, the inside story of the Trayvon Martin injustice and why we continue to repeat it. And we're going to be talking with Lisa about Ray Rice, him beating his wife, and the bigger question of the violence against women in this society, all right? But opening the show up, there's something very, very critical confronting all of us on the planet today. And that is the situation with the climate. This planet is being murdered, and we got to start acting to do something about that. Joining us to talk about this is Orpheus Reed. He's a writer with Revolution Newspaper and part of the Capitalism is Destroying the Planet. We need revolution, nothing less, contingent in the People's Climate March. Orpheus, welcome to the show.
Hey, Michael. How you doing? Glad to be here.
Yeah, good to have you, man. Let's jump into it because I got a lot to ask you, okay?
Okay, yeah, a lot to talk about.
Yeah. Now, you went to New York to be part of the People's Climate March, and you're speaking at different places and all that, but you're also there as one of the organizers of the Capitalism is Destroying the Planet. We need revolution, nothing less, contingent. Tell people what that's about and why you're doing it.
Right. Well, this contingent really is saying that we've seen these summits go on for decades and decades. They repeatedly keep talking about the danger. They talk and talk. They wring their hands. And, you know, this is happening. These decades of climate summits have happened as the scientists have increasingly rung the alarm about the danger of climate change over and over and over again, right? And the summits of these world leaders, of these leading capitalist powers have done nothing about this situation, nothing of substance at all. So what we're really saying with this contingent, what we're doing is we're mobilizing people to come out, and we're saying really that the problem that we're facing in terms of the destruction of the planet is a whole system of capitalism. The problem is bigger than big oil, and it's bigger than just the corporations. You know, we have a whole profit-based system here where everything is based on profit, everything is driven by competition and rivalry with other powers, and that we need an actual revolution to do away with this. So this contingent is really, on the one hand, we're really joining in and standing up along with people. This is a very important moment to kind of work to wrench the trajectory of the planet off the one that we're on towards catastrophe. So we're joining in with people to stand up against this, but at the same time, we're really fighting to raise sights to people understanding that we're up against the whole system and that there's a need for revolution and there's actually a way out through revolution. There's a way we could deal with this crisis with a whole new society and a different system.
Well, let me ask you this, Orpheus, because, you know, you're right. A lot of people, I mean, and including people who are actually pretty sharp on the whole question of what's happening to the climate. But when they look around and they look for the source of the problem, they talk about big oil or corporations, and you arguing that it's capitalism itself. And part of what you're saying, and I know what the contingent says, is that this system isn't and cannot be a fit caretaker of the earth. It's not like all we got to do is turn a few screws in a different direction and the system can then grind on while treating the planet better and healing it and the rest of this stuff. But you're saying that this system cannot be a fit caretaker of the planet. Why?
Yeah, it can't be a fit caretaker of the planet because the whole foundation of the system is based on exploitation of people. It's based on exploitation of resources in the planet, too. It's a commodity system. Everything that's produced is a commodity, something to be bought and sold, right? People's labor is a commodity. And the way the system functions, too, it sees nature as a commodity, just a resource, something to go out and get and grab and pour into production for profit, right? It's driven to do this. And it's also driven by kind of this anarchy of production where all of these capitalists are vying with each other. There's tremendous rivalry with each other over who's going to get these resources, who's going to exploit labor in the most efficient way, who's going to get all the fossil fuels that remain in the ground. And if they don't get it, then someone else is going to get it, and they're going to end up being beat out in this kind of shark, doggy dog kind of system that exists. So there's something really foundational. There's really something fundamental about the way the whole system operates. It's not even that they don't want to recognize climate change. I mean, in some ways, they're beginning to really recognize the danger of climate change and what it can mean, but they approach it still from the economics and politics and the priorities of the system of capitalism, which have nothing to do with the interests of the people and they have nothing to do with the interest of the planet and the needs of the planet. Decisions aren't made based on, and this is really the truth. Decisions aren't made based on kind of the future ecosystems, how we preserve and protect those. Decisions are based on like the economic needs and profitability and rivalry and competition between these various world powers, with the U.S. in the lead on that.
Mm-hmm. That jumps right into where I was going to take this, because it is really interesting. I mean, it's very, with all these points, you're looking at some people who, you have people who are big, major forces in their field, some field of science, some field of climate science, the rest of this. You have all of this stuff going on, and yet still they actually, they look at things and they think, okay, well, we can deal with it. And there's a point here of people looking at the government leaders and other people like these ones I was talking about and saying, all we have to do is convince them that it's happening. And you realize sooner or later, if you study this enough or you're part of this movement enough, you realize that these people actually do understand what's going on. But as you're saying, they choose to do something completely different. Now, there are significant forces in the climate movement these days that also argue in relation to that, that we need to get the U.S. back to what it was in terms of being a moral beacon in the world, in terms of being a fighter for justice in the American way, right? And Superman will spin the planet and clean out all the carbons and all that other stuff. But they say that the U.S., after all, has to take the lead in doing this around the world. Let's talk about that. What do you think of that?
Well, for instance, there's this panel that's happening where they're calling for the U.S. to lead. Leading environmentalists are calling for the U.S. to lead. And there's a huge problem with this on many different levels. Starting with, the truth of the matter is the U.S. has been leading when it comes to climate change. They're the leading contributor in the history of the world to the buildup of greenhouse gases that are destroying our planet. That's the truth. They're also the U.S. military, right, which is a military of empire, is the largest institutional consumer of oil on the planet today. So the truth of the matter is all along the U.S. has been leading. The U.S. has been leading in destroying the environment, in causing climate change and so forth. So that's one point, but further the point, there's a larger point that this is a whole empire, right? They're also leading in terms of, we're seeing again, they're warring on people in Iraq. They're backing Israel and slaughtering people in Gaza and so forth. And this is all part of the picture. They're continually upholding, and this system upholds and justifies the murder of black youth, such as we saw with Michael Brown in Ferguson, right? And does nothing to the police who does it. So these are all aspects of this system and how it operates. And it really can't do anything except for operate based on this, what I'm speaking to, this kind of deeper underlying foundation of capitalism, and then the political institutions and the government and so forth, which sometimes people see it kind of like, well, we could just, these people got to wake up at some point, don't they? This is madness what's happening, and this is insane. It is insane, but the problem is not that we're just dealing with some other people here, some other people in government and leaders who can make rational decisions just like us and kind of come to their senses at some point. The problem is we're not just dealing with people. Yes, they're people, but we're dealing with people that run and are representatives of a killing and destroying system. So we've got to face up to that. And there's a lot of reality, too, in terms of what Obama, for example, has actually done. He's sort of couched himself now most recently as the president that will do, for the first time, really do something serious about climate change. But the reality is that the changes he's calling for, like these cuts in emissions from coal plants, are pitiful compared to what's really needed. On the one hand, not even clear that they will happen, because we live in a country where there's whole sections of the ruling class, for example, that don't even believe in climate change, right? Don't believe in evolution or climate change. And so that's part of the situation. That's part of the equation. And then what Obama has actually done, if you look what he's actually done, the U.S. has, under Obama, the U.S. has become, it's either the leading or one of the leading producers of oil on the planet, right? There's been a vast expansion through fracking, which is very environmentally destructive in its own right, but also the development of these huge new reserves of gas from shale rock and so forth through this destructive fracking practice. And the U.S. is actually using these new reserves of oil and gas, which are continually trumpeted and expanded under Obama. He's using these reserves as a weapon of empire, right? A way to bring Iran to heel, for example, a way that they can proceed with their rivalry with the Soviet Union over the Ukraine and so forth. So this is how they approach everything, from the economics and the politics of capitalism. And so any kind of thinking that the U.S. should lead on this is we're going to fall into getting behind the force that is the leading mangler, the leading destroyer of the people and the planet today.
Well, let me remind listeners that you're tuned into The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Orpheus Reed, a writer for Revolution Newspaper, and part of the Capitalism is Destroying the Planet, We Need Revolution, Nothing Less Contingent in the People's Climate March. Orpheus, you know, it's interesting when you're talking about Obama, because there is this stuff about what you're saying about, you know, really him, you know, running around yelling about how he's restoring America to its leading role in the oil production in this, you know, for the first time there, most of their oil is coming from inside the borders of the U.S. But he also did something that I know must have hit you very hard because you were down there in the wake of the BP oil spill. He's opened up an additional 59 million acres for oil and gas drilling in the Gulf of Mexico, right, despite many experts saying, are you nuts?
Right, exactly. So this is another example of, like, and again, not just because of Obama's intentions or whatever, but really because of the way that the system is really forced to operate, right? All of these fossil fuels, they see them as great reserves of one being the foundation of the way the whole world economic system functions, right? So if you control these things, there's tremendous profit to be made for U.S. capital, right? But they're also a reserve, as I was pointing to before, they're a reserve for how you carry out great nation rivalry with other capitalist countries. So this is exactly what Obama has done. Open up, you know, right on the heels of this tremendous disaster in the Gulf, right? Now they're opening up huge new sections of the Gulf to oil drilling. They're also, the other thing Obama has done is open up huge swaths of the Atlantic Ocean, so from like Florida to Delaware, to exploration for drilling for gas and oil. And he's also, and these are, you know, kind of like from White House fact sheets, they have sped up the leasing of permits for drilling on federal lands and expanded drilling on federal lands. And they trumpet this as like great accomplishments that he's done. And I mean, further, like Obama, in terms of the Copenhagen climate summit that happened in 2009, I think it was, that here was a time when people all over the world were thinking, okay, finally, the scientific consensus is in. Finally, someone like Obama is head of the U.S. Now there'll be a binding climate treaty that will actually bind all these different nations to cutting emissions. And what happens is Obama goes over there and basically sabotages this kind of agreement and forces an agreement down where every country is allowed to suggest, you know, we think that it's in our interest to be able to cut this much and we're going to try to do it, right? We're going to try to cut this much, you know, small amounts, nowhere near the kind of emission cuts that are really necessary that are demanded by the situation that we're facing today, which is really a catastrophe in the making. Mm-hmm. Right. This is the stakes are just huge for humanity of where things are going. There's already huge disaster that's happening. We're seeing all these changes already. Some catastrophic things in terms of the melting of the Antarctic ice sheets, and now, you know, potentially the melting of Greenland may become unstoppable. You know, so we're already seeing these huge and cataclysmic events that are accelerating, and these people doing nothing about it. Right. And saying, oh, we're going to do it from within the things that are in our national interest. We're going to do it in a way that doesn't hurt too much. So they're making these small and proposing these small and pitiful cuts in their emissions. And the world actually demands a revolutionary change, a whole new situation, an immediate stop, immediate move to get off fossil fuels and to transition as a world to green energy.
All right, Orpheus, we have one last question. Before we get into that, there was something I was going to ask you about, but we're running up on our time, but I want to recommend that people go to revcom.us and read the coverage that's on there. And you have an article that appeared a little while ago called CNA Military Advisory Report, Climate Change and U.S. Global Supremacy, which I found shocking, enraging, and really important for people to see. Can you just give people a one-minute capsule of what that is? And I recommend they go to revcom.us and check it out. And then I want to ask you about how things can be different under a socialist society in broad strokes.
Okay, sure. Just briefly, this is an article that I did about a report that came out in May, and this is a report from a thing called the CNA Military Advisory Report former high-ranking U.S. military officials, high-ranking government officials, and so forth. And basically what they're saying in this report is they're talking about the real danger that climate change poses to the planet. Off of the reports from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change and other scientific reports, they're talking about the real dangers, the huge changes that this will mean in terms of drought, sea level rise, increasing extremity of storms and all these other things. But they're coming at it from the viewpoint, and they're advocating that the U.S. imperialists, and particularly the U.S. military, has to take this into account in order to preserve its national power. This is how they're looking at it. So the very same system that is causing this catastrophe in the first place, that continues to expand its use of fossil fuels, et cetera, is talking about how will they preserve their power in the face of this kind of disaster. How can they come out on top, including they're very worried about things like the sea level rise and the effect on U.S. military naval institutions, such as the Norfolk Naval Base. So they're really kind of sounding alarm to the other rulers in the U.S. We've got to deal with this. We've got to look at it. But they're only doing so not from the viewpoint of preserving ecosystems and people, but from how their system can remain in power. It's really just criminal and outrageous.
Well, let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Orpheus Reed, a writer for Revolution Newspaper, and part of the Capitalism is Destroying the Planet, We Need Revolution, Nothing Less Contingent in the People's Climate March. Well, let's, in the 3 minutes we have left, try and give people a sense of how things could be different under socialism. I recommend that people can go to, and you can tell them the special issue on the environment that they can go to, but really go to revcom.us and check this stuff out, because it's really important to get a sense of there is an alternative that's possible.
Right. So, yeah, I definitely want to really have people go to revcom.us. And so it's revcom.us/environment is the special issue that we put out on the environmental emergency. That this is a very, very important issue, because it's talking about kind of the dimensions of the environmental crisis, really the stakes and where things are at. But it's really digging in a deep way into this question of capitalism, and also the question of how revolution and a new socialist society really could bring forward principles of socialist sustainable development and really deal with the environment in a totally different way for the first time. So yeah, I want to encourage people to do that.
Mm-hmm.
So do you have some? Yeah, go ahead.
No. Well,
I mean, I can just keep riffing, but
no. I wish we had more time, but I would. There is a okay. point. We can take 2 minutes, I think, and if you could just like give people, even in that issue, there's some points made about how you can create a sustainable society, an economy and society in cooperation with nature and in working with nature and whatnot, and how socialism will handle what's been done, how to reverse this, how to bring things back, and how to work within the planet as a whole. Give people a sense of the headlines that to sort of whet their appetite.
Yeah, sure. I mean, so this is talking about, first of all, really starting from the international dimension and internationalism. And so this new socialist state would really be a base area for the world revolution. And that's demanded both by kind of the situation humanity faces, but also the ecological crisis is a worldwide one. So we really have to deal with it on that scale with that urgency. And so this new socialist state would actually put the interests of the preservation of ecosystems of the entire planet above its own national development. It would give, kind of like scientific, technical, and organizational backing. It would really unleash scientists and also the masses of people for the first time to talk about how can we repair ecosystems, how can we allow them to recover, because this is going to be a very intense situation, right? This system has already brought into being a whole situation where we're going to be dealing with immense catastrophe, immense huge problems at the very least under socialism. It's going to be a high wire act dealing with this. So it's not, we're not seeing this as just like a magic thing that will take power and the destruction of the ecosystems is over. It's going to be a battle to do that. We're going to have to mobilize understanding, mobilize scientists, and also to a great degree do things that are not further damaging and transform things. So some other types of things that will be involved is like really consciously planning, regulating growth, protecting and preserving ecosystems. So breaking with this kind of like this whole blind expansion, this reckless and blind expansion that capitalism does for a planned economy, for one that's based on meeting the needs of people, that's one that takes the kind of the limits and the needs of the ecosystem into account and that plans things based on that. So that would be part of it. And then there would also be kind of a transformation of the whole structure of agriculture and industry and so forth away from the way things are done now, just kind of like all-out growth and development for profit, but based on the things that people actually need and really kind of reorienting things away from that, moving off fossil fuels, bringing forward green energy for real, sustainable energy, getting away from this whole transportation grid where everything is kind of the automobile. Everybody's got their own automobile and we're driving over it. So there's these long, you know, long lines of transportation and exchange and so forth in favor of, you know, more of an economy that's based on regional exchanges and local exchanges and things adapted to the local needs and so forth. There'd be a different kind of city, you know, breaking, you know, more production in the city and a break with consumerism, you know, getting away from that and really fundamentally bringing forward a society where the planet would be valued, where the people would really be caretakers of the planet and taught to do that. And we'd be interacting with nature in that way and learning from nature and giving people an appreciation and really seeing it as our kind of the thing our society would need to do to really be, to really preserve the whole future of this planet. We have that responsibility.
All right. And on that
note, the kind of world it would be.
Okay. And on that note, Orpheus, I want to thank you very much for joining us today.
Okay, thanks a lot, Michael. Good to talk to you.
Yeah, you too. Talk to you again soon, man. All right, you're listening to The Michael Slate Show. We've just been talking with Orpheus Reed, writer for Revolution Newspaper, and part of the capitalism is killing the planet. We need revolution, nothing less, contingent in the People's Climate March. And once again, don't forget that you can get the most radical coverage you're ever going to find on the environmental movement and everything else. You can get all kinds of information at revcom.us. That's revcom.us. And you're going to get revolutionary news there, revolutionary analysis. You're going to get all kinds of news about the movement for revolution, where it's at, and how you can be part of it, all right? And in particular, go there now and look for the special issue of Revolution Newspaper called State of Emergency, The Plunder of Our Planet, The Environmental Catastrophe, and The Real Revolutionary Solution. Again, that's at revcom.us. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate. We're going to take a quick musical break, and when we come back, we'll be speaking with Lisa Bloom, attorney, news analyst, and author, and we'll be talking about Ray Rice and the National Football League and a whole society that just produces, reproduces, and continues to nurture and spread the most horrific violence against women. So stay tuned.
Looking out on the morning rain, I used to feel so uninspired. When I knew I had to face another day, Lord, it made me feel so tired.
All right, welcome back. That was You Made Me Feel Like a Natural Woman, Laura Nyro and LaBelle. Okay, and I played that because we're about to talk about something really horrific. And I felt that this was important to start this way. To start this way because it's what, you know, so often, so many people, men and women, go into relationships and thinking, this is what I want, this is what I really want. I want a relationship where I get respect and love. And they end up in a brutal, brutal situation. Well, I'll just read you a couple of statistics. One out of every three women will be abused at some point in her life. Battering is the single major cause of injury to women, including rapes, muggings, and auto accidents combined. All right, about 4,000 women die each year due to domestic violence. Approximately 75% of women who are killed by their batterers are murdered when they attempt to leave or after they have left an abusive relationship. Every hour, every minute, every 15 seconds, a woman is beaten in the U.S. And according to the World Health Organization, 35% of women worldwide have been the victims of sexual violence during their lifetimes. According to domestic violence experts, more than three women in the U.S. lose their lives at the hands of their partners every day. And you know what? Since this Ray Rice video has come out, more than 600 women have been killed in the U.S. This is very heavy. It's a very heavy situation. And joining us to talk about this is Lisa Bloom. Lisa is an attorney, a trial lawyer, national journalist, and the award-winning author of her latest book, which is Suspicion Nation, The Inside Story of the Trayvon Martin Injustice and Why We Continue to Repeat It. And she's been writing a lot about the situation facing women in particular. I had a lot of comments to make about this recent Ray Rice, just horrific crime. Lisa, welcome back to the show.
Thank you so much for having me. And yes, I've been writing about this a lot. My blogs are on avvo.com, A-V-V-O.com, if people want to take a look.
Mm-hmm. Well, you start off the piece that you wrote pretty quick after the release of this new video. You start off saying, what the hell? Why did it take a video to actually bring things to a head? Let's talk about mm-hmm. that.
Yeah, I mean, what was so disturbing is that the NFL and prosecutors, each of whom should be accountable for their sweeping all of this under the rug, they've known for many months that Ray Rice struck his then-fiancée in the face, knocked her out, and there was the first video was of him dragging her out of the elevator unconscious. So it wasn't hard to put together what happened inside the elevator. But it was only when TMZ released the video of what happened inside the elevator that the NFL woke up and realized that this was a very serious problem. But the facts didn't change. What changed was we had a vivid representation of the facts. And some people have said to me that in moments of real candor, look, I had to see that too to really understand. It really had to be right in front of me. I think we have very high levels of denial in this country about domestic violence. We don't want to look it in the eye. We don't want to look at a video of a man punching his girlfriend out to the point of unconsciousness. Or remember Rihanna's face a couple years ago, that bruised and battered face from what her boyfriend Chris Brown did to her. There's an audio tape of Judge Fuller, a federal judge, who was assaulting his wife, and she called the police, and she's screaming and yelling, and you can hear thuds in the background. It's very hard to listen to, but we have to listen to that stuff. We have to watch the videos. We have to read the accounts so that we can really face what's going on.
Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Lisa Bloom. Lisa's a trial attorney, national journalist, and award-winning author, and we're talking about, you know, Lisa, you raise a question here, and I was thinking about this last night as I was getting ready for the show. I saw a movie called Private Violence. I saw it up at Sundance this year, which was all about domestic violence and what happens to women. And it was focused on this small town. You know, it was like Americana, you know. And in it, these women were being horrifically battered and bruised. And, you know, I mean, it was just terrible. It was a terrible situation. The things that they had to go through to even try to get out of it, which a few of them managed to, a lot of them didn't. But you, just what you were just talking about, this thing about this sort of, we don't want to believe this. How much do you look at that as the situation or this problem of there's actually contorted, distorted, warped thinking in relationship to women and violence against women? You know, a lot
well,
of the
I
stuff.
Think it's,
go ahead.
Yeah,
go
I
ahead.
Think it's both. And this is the problem in the Adrian Peterson child abuse case as well. I am a practicing attorney in Los Angeles. I've represented abused children and battered women and various kinds of victims and family law cases for almost three decades. And when I first began this kind of work, I thought, well, gee, everyone's against child abuse. Everyone's against beating women and their wives, right? I mean, this shouldn't be difficult. But in fact, the opposite was true. While people are against it in a general sense, in any specific case, there's a heavy level of denial that's very hard to get around. And that's especially true when the batterer is a wealthy person or a celebrity or both. Everybody will circle the wagons to protect the person with money. So in the Adrian Peterson case, for example, even though he caused lacerations on the genitals of his 4-year-old son, which are photographed and which he's admitted to, you know, many prominent people like Sean Hannity or Charles Barkley support him and say, well, he really didn't do anything wrong. Why? Because this is a very prominent person. A little 4-year-old boy doesn't make money for anyone. Ray Rice's wife isn't making any money for anyone that I know of. And so these are people who are considered expendable. And, you know, ultimately this violence is sort of swept under the rug and people don't take it seriously.
Yeah, but, you know, I agree, and except that, you know, there's something here. I mean, you see a hell of a lot more uproar around dogs being, and look, I'm a major dog lover, you know. I collect large dogs, right, that nobody else wants, right? Yeah, Rottweilers are really cute.
Oh, that's
but,
great.
Yeah, but I'll tell you know what, if I was to go out and smack my dog around, I'd have three neighbors saying, what the hell are you doing? Stop that. And the thing is that there's something that happens in relation to the way this society is built in terms of the patriarchy, in terms of all this other stuff. A woman is she's never believed. And it's always, like they said with Ray Rice's wife, you know, with Janae Palmer, they said, well, she took her responsibility for her part in what happened. You know, there's always that little conditioner that's involved there that actually says somehow a woman is responsible for what happens in this.
Well, first of all, I don't want to ever set up a conflict between people who stand up for the rights of animals, as I do, and people who stand up for the rights of women or children or African Americans. I think we're all on the same side.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm a great animal rights person, as well as, you know, believing in equality for all humans. In fact, most people who are animal rights people are the most outspoken when it comes to protecting women and children and racial minorities, et cetera. But to your point, you know, listen, Jhené Rice is clearly a battered woman. I mean, we all saw the video of her being punched in the face and being dragged out. And she deserves no judgment from any of us. I think she deserves only compassion. Many of us have been through experiences like she's been through, and it takes a while to come out of that experience. The NFL put her on a stage in a press conference, and I'm sure that they vetted her remarks in advance, where she then apologized for her part in this, I guess for being a punching bag. I mean, I don't know what her part. There's nothing that a woman can say that merits being punched in the face to the point of unconsciousness or being hit at all. No human being should be hit. No child, no woman, no man, no one, no animal should be hit, as far as I'm concerned. It's completely unnecessary, and we should be past that. But I like to look at the people at the top rather than the people at the bottom. And that's why I'm talking about the NFL and their responsibility in this. And by the way, the local prosecutors who have really escaped a lot of notice in this. But the local prosecutors who decided to give Ray Rice a very sweet plea deal where he just does a little counseling and eventually his charges will be dropped and it'll be as though this never happened. And if this something like this happens in the future, it will be considered his first offense. That's indefensible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. You know, and let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Lisa Bloom. Lisa's a trial attorney, national journalist, and award-winning author, and we're talking about what she's been writing about and her thoughts on the Ray Rice domestic violence brouhaha that's up. And actually, frankly, brouhaha is not quite the term. It's just a horrific, horrific situation and something that really I'm concerned because, I'll tell you, Lisa, the kind of divide in society that needs to form up around this doesn't seem to have formed up, and I'm very concerned about that.
Let me say this. I mean, you and I both believe that incarcerating everyone is not really the answer.
Mm-hmm.
And while I believe that people who are violent do deserve to be incarcerated, really what you're doing is you're dealing with an after-the-fact situation once you get to the criminal justice system. What we need is prevention. So what we need is to get over this idea that manliness equates with violence. I mean, in my view, a real man is somebody who stops the cycle of violence. So when we see Adrian Peterson, who is a great role model to a lot of little boys, basically saying it's okay to whip a child and to cause marks and lacerations on his head and his hands and his genitals. I mean, on his hands. This four-year-old had defensive wounds on his hands. No four-year-old should have defensive wounds. So we need a different definition of manhood that we give to our boys. That's what's going to help stop this at the source. We need men like you, like you're doing, bless you, and other men who are role models to say, violence is not the answer. I stand against violence. You know, a real man treats a woman with respect, treats a child with respect. I think we got to stop this at the very earliest stages.
You know, I'll tell you something, though, Lisa, I really appreciate what you're saying. I also think, too, though, that we got to get beyond a sense of manhood because there's so much tied up in that real manhood that just, you know, it oozes something. It just makes me itch, you know. It's like, it's terrible.
But, you know, a little boy is going to look to you or look to anyone who's in the pot and say, you know, how should I be
right.
as a man?
Right.
What does it mean to be a man? I mean, that's just the way children are.
Right. And I think and I agree. And I'm not really arguing with you, but I'm just telling you what I think here because it's sort of, I do think we need to. You know, we need to have humanity of two genders or many whatever, you know, it's different expressions of that. We live as humans, and no one human is superior to another based on anything, you know. And this is the thing that really gets me. And we have time for maybe one last question. And one of the things that I wanted to talk to you about is two times this has happened, and it really gives you a sense of the breadth of this and the depth of this situation, this problem, this horror. You know, even though people ask, well, why did she stay? Why didn't she leave? And right now, which was very heartening, there was a response from someone who started the hashtag why I stayed and hashtag why I left, which mirrored what happened in the wake of the killings, up the brutal killings, this misogynistic killings up in Santa Barbara that was, hashtag yes all women. And it shows something the depth and how pervasive this is in this society.
Yes. You know, I was so moved by one tweet where a woman said, because my child needs a father, hashtag why I stayed. because my child needs a mother, hashtag why I left. You know, it's a very difficult, complicated situation. If you have a child, if you don't want to have a relationship that failed, if you feel that it's your fault, if you love this person, if love has always equated with violence and pain in your life, if you don't have a support system, if there's no battered women's shelter in your community, as you point out, the most dangerous time for a battered woman is the point at which she leaves. Many are threatened with their very lives if they leave. So it's a very difficult, complicated situation. But as Joe Biden said recently, we should never, never, never blame the battered woman. It's always the fault of the batterer, and we should be asking why they batter, not why women stay.
And I would add something that I want people to ask, which is ask why the hell we live in a society, in a world that actually promotes this kind of stuff and allows, not only allows it to continue to exist, but actually the soil keeps nurturing it in ways that we've got to stop. So,
yeah, we've got to make nonviolence sexy. We've got to make nonviolence something that we teach. Nonviolence is difficult. Martin Luther King and the civil rights activists, they had to take classes and learn how to be nonviolent. This is not something that just comes naturally. So this is something we have to teach in the schools at the earliest grades and reinforce throughout life, how to handle disputes and conflicts in a nonviolent manner.
All right, Lisa, we're going to wrap this up. And do you have anything else you'd like to add before we go? We have about a minute left.
No, I just think we do live in one of the most violent developed countries. We have one of the highest rates of child abuse and domestic violence in the developed world. I mean, 30 countries in the world ban hitting children, for example. Sweden banned it in the 1970s. 30 other countries followed. We are not one of them. I think we should be one of them. I think when a child is hit as punishment, that child grows up to think that hitting is appropriate, that hitting is a way to solve problems. And that's a big part of the problem that we have.
Mm-hmm. And we'll go out with this. Just remember that every 15 seconds a woman is beaten in the U.S. Yes. So think how many women have been beaten in just the time we've been talking. Lisa, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you, Michael. Take care.
Take care. Talk to you again soon. Bye. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we've just been talking with Lisa Bloom, attorney, author, and blogger, and generally someone who's speaking her mind on the abuse of women in this society. And we're going to take a quick break and be right back with the cast and director of Equivocation. You don't want to miss this one, all right? So stay tuned.
It's time for truth, the barker said, and poured himself a beer. Oh yeah, forsooth, said Ben the Geek, but who'll be left to hear? They've driven off the fools and saints, and now they stole the show. It's all a bloody circus, mates, and clowns are in control. If that's the truth, said Marzipan, the midget from the floor, I know there won't be no demand for midgets anymore. We used to be a novelty by simply being small, but next to them, unholy men, now Tiny Tim looks tall.
All right. Yeah, that's right. That's actually Kris Kristofferson, and it's Slouching into the Millennium, and it's from his album A Moment Forever, A Moment of Forever, and it's a song I felt really moved. I'll tell you guys now, I'll let people know first that joining me in the studio right now, and I'm having a very hard time controlling them, okay, is the director Mike Peebler and the actors Ted Barton and Taylor Jackson Ross. And Ted plays Shag, Shakespeare, and Taylor plays Shag's daughter, Judith. And Mike is the director of this. He's the ringmaster, okay?
Oh,
that's
boy.
What's going on here.
Guilty as charged.
Yeah, and we'll talk about this in just a minute, but I got to tell you, I'm really concerned, all right? So if there's a lot of screaming and yelling and running around you hear going on, call for help, okay? Because I have to tell you guys, this play was over the top. The play's Equivocation. I loved the damn thing. I couldn't get enough of it. I'm thinking of going back to see it again because I want to take people who didn't see it, and I just thought it was great, so... All right. Well, before we get into this, let me talk a little bit about why I thought it was important to be doing a story on this play today. Now, for those of you who aren't in a city where the play is currently being featured, it doesn't mean that you don't need to know about or want to know about what the play is about and all the critical questions that are being spoken to in this play, because they are questions that are important for all of us today, no matter where we are and no matter what we have accessible to us. This play is a play that poses big questions for anyone who's a thinking human being in this country and indeed in the world. It was written by playwright Bill Kane, and it's called Equivocation, and it hurdles us back to London in 1605, where Shakespeare, which was a name Shakespeare was apparently known by, is a well-known playwright writing an experimental drama about a king who goes mad. But the actual king's secretary of state slash spymaster wants Shakespeare to write a propaganda play presenting the official government version of the gunpowder plot, in which a group of Catholics led by Guy Fawkes in Britain conspired to blow up the British Parliament. The result is a tour de force of history, comedy, and witty dialogue. So now let's talk about the play. Let's start. I don't know who to start with. Mike, let's start with you.
All right.
To give people a sense of what the play is.
Sure. It's a wonderful, you know, we have this idea that history is sort of set and we know what things are and how things happened. One of the most wonderful things about Shakespeare is that the man himself and his process is a total mystery, pretty much. And so this play is a wonderful look at how Shakespeare and his troupe of actors may have written one of his most famous plays during a time of great sort of political, religious turmoil in England, which can sound a little historical dry, and yet the playwright has managed to write a play that it leaps off the page and off the stage.
All right. Yes, it does. In fact, literally many
literally.
Times. There you go. So let's talk about it a little bit more, though, because there's also the title. I want to get this straight because I want people to understand. Like, Ted, you play Shakespeare. When people see that as Shakespeare, it's not exactly the character that maybe, at least not in academics, you find as Shakespeare. This is actually much more a human Shakespeare, which I think, as you were saying, you know, sort of fills out the humanity of the playwright. But also, there's bigger questions we'll get into later. But how did you find doing that?
Well, I that's very true. I think... Not that I know, I'm not Bill Kane, the playwright, but I think that's why he chose to use an alternate spelling of Shakespeare's name, Shagspear, for the character, because I think that right off the bat gets us out of the whole potential pitfall of this icon, the greatest playwright of all time. And I think very much the effort is to present him as human as possible. Is a man making his way in the world and providing for his family and working with this troupe of actors with whom he has collaborated for years. And it's the play broadly is very much his response to the political and religious turmoil that Mike was talking about. And what is the individual's response? What is the role of the individual conscience of the artist in a corrupt society faced with a government that is recruiting him, attempting to tell its propaganda?
Mm-hmm. And to create a situation that actually will allow for even greater crimes to go on being committed.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
It's very heavy in terms of it. And this is the thing that gets me about the play is it's got so many stories going on at once and it's got so many times going on at once. And then the characters, except for Shakespeare, Shag, and Shag's daughter, you're the only two that don't play other characters.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Somebody said, well, it's going to be hard. No, it's not. It's just, you're just sucked in. You're drawn into the world there, and it becomes so powerful, you know, and especially around this question that you're saying, what's posed for people. Taylor, I have to ask you about this because you're the only woman in the cast. Yeah, there you go. Yeah, and the thing is, now, stay away from the clock. You can't push the time back, okay? No matter what you did on stage, you can't do it here. Well, you could. If you can, let me know.
We'll
anyway.
Just for you. We'll
thank you. Taylor, your character is, in part, is a character that sort of is in the background all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Except there are moments that where you take that being in the background and you just capture so much of what's happening there and what's being said there. I mean, you do this whole thing about just nailing Shakespeare, nailing Shakespeare about... Oh, God, are we going to have those damn soliloquies and all these things?
Yeah.
It's a very interesting character.
She is. It's really wild when you've got a cast. It's only six people. There's only one woman. And, you know, that's in plays, it's not necessarily a thing to celebrate. It's like, why aren't there two? Why aren't there three? Why not all six? Why not? But there is something wonderful in the fact that every time Judith shows up in the play, people go, oh, she's going to talk. Oh, that's exciting. She's wearing a dress. That's different. You know, they get into it. And she is, I think it's wonderful to kind of look at her as sort of she's a lot of forgotten voices in this play, because most of the people that Shag runs into in his journey through this show are going to be men because of the time period. Everybody who's in the government, everybody who's running the prison where he visits, everybody who was involved in the conspiracy. I mean, they all had women in their lives, but when he goes to the office, the person sitting at the desk is a man. And so Judith is sort of everybody who's there who doesn't get asked their opinion about any of these things. And she's got a lot of hurt, but she's able to kind of look at the truth of the thing and ask him, like, what are you really going for here? Because I see you, and I don't like a lot of the things that you do, but I see how much you care, and I don't know why you would ever stop yourself from doing it. So she wants him to go forward and to find truth.
Yeah, but at the same time, I mean, one of the things that happens with her is also that she's got a hole mm-hmm. in her heart somewhere and in her head. And,
oh, yeah.
And she's really trying to fill it. It comes across with every move you make on the stage, I think. It's really, even when you're just gathering up laundry or something, it's there, you know, and I think it's very important and very powerful because there is that relationship, like we were talking about earlier, that both Mike and Ted were talking about in terms of what are the political questions, which I want to get into a little bit later in a minute. But there's also this question that's very human part of it that you drive home. Mm-hmm. And Ted, your character, Shakespeare, actually has to, it's one of the few times I think I've seen that Shakespeare becomes so vulnerable and human at a certain point, both in the relationship to his dead son, but also in relationship to his living daughter, who for all intents and purposes actually is a wraith in his presence. So what do you think of that?
Go ahead.
No.
Directorially, Judith is the cornerstone of the show. And we talked about this when we were working on those soliloquies. She is the way in for the audience. Because if you do a play that's about this political strife and this religious strife but has no heart, there's no hook for the audience, right? You have to get them in with something they can relate to. And writing a play in Elizabethan England is not an experience most people are going to be able to get into.
What are you talking about?
That's my weekend right there. Come on.
So for me, directorially, getting Judith right was hugely important. I saw, casting the play, more Judiths than any other part. I was all over the map with Judith. I couldn't figure out what I was going to do with Judith until I saw Taylor, because it's such an important and yet complicated and tricky, delicate little part. As you know, having seen the show, she doesn't say a whole lot, but when she does, it counts. And so directorially, it was just so important for me to get those moments right so that the audience could come in with their heart, which then allows them into the world to experience all the other stuff in a visceral, not intellectual way. Did you want to talk about the relationship?
I was just going to say it is, of course, always tempting dealing with Shakespeare because there is so much that we don't know. It's always tempting to look at the plays and extrapolate from them and say, oh, well, clearly he must have been going through this because it's reflected in this play. That, of course, is not necessarily the case, and we'll never know. But it is suggestive, certainly, that as Judith tells the audience at the end of Equivocation, the last, what we call the romances, these last plays of Shakespeare, they all deal with the father and daughter being reunited. And, you know, again, we can't necessarily say, as Bill Kane does in Equivocation, well, that's what was going on in his life. But certainly in his creative life, in his imagination, it preoccupied him enormously at the end of his life.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate. We're talking today with Mike Peebler, the director of the play Equivocation, and the actors Ted Barton, who plays Shag, or Shagspear, which is another name for Shakespeare, and Taylor Jackson Ross, who plays Shag's daughter, Judith. And the play is all about Shakespeare and his relation to the British monarchy. And as they tried to make him write a play that would incriminate a group of Catholics led by Guy Fawkes in a conspiracy to blow up Parliament. And the play is all about how Shakespeare handled all that. And I have to say, I mean, really, dealing with Shakespeare, there's the whole point there where you play him both with the vulnerability that you're talking about in a certain sense of what he's been looking for and what he's been searching for. But then there's also this point about he actually is put in a jam that concentrates the relationship between art and politics and the relationship between morality and immorality. And it's something that I think gets carried out really well in the relationship. And there's so many relationships we could talk about in the play, but it would take us an entire hour. So I wanted you to talk about that a little bit because there's that combination of the deeply human thing that's coming out and then the point about, wait a minute,
there's something very wrong going on in England right now, and they want me to back it up, and I can't do it.
Right. One of the sort of one of the subterranean themes in the play is it's thought that Shakespeare's father was a recusant, that is, a Catholic who failed to comply with the Reformation in England. Throughout Equivocation, Shakespeare's father is constantly invoked. And I think when Shag meets these conspirators who are being tortured and killed for their beliefs, essentially he's confronting people who did stand up for what they believed in. And I think Shag feels as if he's failed his father because he did not. And in fact has become a wildly successful playwright and the playwright for the King's acting company, and so to a certain extent has been co-opted. And certainly Robert Cecil, the King's minister who commissions Shag to write this play about the gunpowder plot, thinks he has him pegged and thinks he's just throw some money at him and he'll do whatever he's told. And I think in large part Shag's journey in the play is discovering, oh, I don't want to be that. I don't want to be a patsy. I actually want to have some integrity in my life, and how do I do that?
Part of the thing is, and this is for anybody, but it's sort of, there is this point of confronted with this terrible evil, which I mean, it really, I really got the sense of when you're, especially when you're visiting the people that are imprisoned and you're visiting the Jesuit priest, and the term equivocation is brought to the forefront, which gives Shakespeare, gives Shagspere, gives Shag a way out of this mess without, in a way that he thinks will, that will, he'll be able to do what he needs to do. But it's just, it's so important there because there's a choice that's made. And I just think it's like, you know, that in terms of the, what's going on with this play. And the fact that it also, I have to say, the fact that it also gives you enough room to make all kinds of jokes about Lear and how one of his most famous and most beloved plays got written, you know. It's just, it's a really remarkable thing. But there's actually this, always this constant underpinning. And maybe you can talk about this more.
Well, yeah, it's... Again, I think it's why this play works right now. It's, and sadly, probably works at any time, but there's this underbelly where people are being tortured, where you've got to toe the party line or there will be consequences, where you've got to tell the story, propaganda story, that will reinforce the government's message or something bad will happen, right? I mean, this is, and that's not just sort of American political stuff. It's all over the world. It happens in every country around the world. So it's a story that has been played out in every culture over and over again, and we all struggle with that. How do we have our own voice in the face of these governmental forces that will literally crush you, Tiananmen Square? So this is relatable in that way of how do you keep your own integrity? How do you express yourself in a way that's true and yet not get squashed for it, right? And that's part of the struggle of this play.
Mm-hmm. And on top of that, the thing that really gets, I think, brought out by the relationship between Shag and his daughter, Shag and his troupe of actors who are his secondary family, really. He's got his biological family, but that group of men is his other family, is how do you stand up for what you believe in? How do you say what you need to say? And you can throw yourself into the fire, but how are you going to do that without dragging the people you love down with you? Mm-hmm. And how can you make that choice for them? His actors get very angry. Why are you doing this? You're putting us into this position. We have families.
Yeah, we want to pay our mortgage.
We want to pay our mortgage and not die horribly in front of people, you know? And it's a very scary position that he's put into.
But it's also a very moving position in terms of what actually gets decided. We got to wrap this up. I can't believe that we've run out of time. But, so I want to thank all of you for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Now, there's something I want to read as we go out today. It's something that I've read a couple of times before, but it's something I think that really, really, there's a crying need for people to think about this. We're talking about the system destroying the planet. We're talking about never-ending police brutality. We're talking about so many women killed through brutal, misogynistic hatred. That's basically what it is, brutal, misogynistic attacks based on the hatred of women and the dehumanization of women. And there's all kinds of things. We can all point to a million and one other things, the brewing wars, the buildup of nuclear weapons once again on the fast track here in the U.S. That's what they've been saying now, is that it's on the fast track. So think about this, right? Think about this as you're looking at the news today, tomorrow, next week, whenever. Just think about this. Do what you're moved to do after you hear this, all right? It is up to us to wake up,
to shake off the ways they put on us, the ways they have us thinking, so they can keep us down and trapped in the same old rat race, to rise up as conscious emancipators of humanity. The days when this system can just keep on doing what it does to people here and all over the world, when people are not inspired and organized to stand up against these outrages and to build up the strength to put an end to this madness, those days must be gone, and they can be. And that's from the Revolutionary Communist Party's message and call, "The Revolution We Need, the Leadership We Have." And just think, folks, let's celebrate the fact that there were over 300,000 people in the streets of New York City demanding that something be done about the murder of the planet, that the ongoing murder of the planet, all right? But let's not stop there. Let's dig into what's really the cause and what it's going to take to cure it all. Well, that's the takeaway message for today. So don't forget it. Spread it around and think about it and do what you got to do after you think about it, okay? You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host and producer, Michael Slate. All right, we're running out, and I just want to thank all of my guests today. I want to thank each and every one of you for tuning in. I want to thank my assistant producer, Henry Carson. I want to thank my production assistant, Jeff Pryor, my board offer today, Teddy Robinson. Great to have you back, Teddy. And I want to thank each and every one of you for tuning in. If you want to write to me, you can at michaelslate@redfuture.com. Again, that's michaelslate@redfuture.com. And if you want to follow me, you can do that on Facebook and Twitter, okay? And we're really going to be trying to amp that all up, all that social media, we're going to be trying to amp that up in the weeks to come. So stay tuned for that. And now we're going to go out with Respect from Aretha Franklin. Just a little bit more of what we all need, but especially in the wake of today's show, let's get some respect. Yeah.